Welcome to Pod Summarizer, the way to summarize your favorite podcasts. Today, we have a summary of My First Million. In this episode, the host engages with Einish to explore the intriguing challenge of turning $10,000 into a million through strategic investing. They discuss the importance of mindset and the right investment choices in a fluctuating market. Remember to follow us on X and Instagram and on our website, podsummarizer.xyz. And now, let's begin.
Okay, here we go. Einish, welcome back. Round two.
Sean, it's always a pleasure.
So let's play a game. You're my coach. You're my investing coach, let's say. And I have $10,000. And I want to turn it into a million, right? Podcast called My First Million. I want to go from 10K to a million. So that's 100X. How would I take 10K and turn it into a million?
The thing about investing is that opportunities are not going to show up just because you have the cash. So I would make some tweaks to your thinking first about the 10K. So I would say, okay, the 10K is a good starting point. But what I also want you to do separately from that is have a day job.
Yeah.
Okay. And I want you to spend less than you're earning. And I want you to take the 10K. And I also want you to take your annual savings. Maybe that's 5-10,000 a year or whatever it is. And normally I would say put it into an index, right? The index, like the S&P, is overheated. Mm. We can't go there right now. Circa 2025, we cannot go into the S&P.
Okay.
Okay, maybe 2035 we can, but not 2025. So what I would do is I would treat Berkshire Hathaway as the index. So I would just say the default currently is you put it, you know, dollar cost average into Berkshire Class B shares,
okay,
right? And you keep doing that day in, day out. And if we did that, you know, the math is really simple. Even if we were doing 10% a year, right? I mean, which I think is pretty reasonable for Berkshire. Rule of 72, we would double every 7 years. Life is all about doubles, okay? Let's say we had a 20-something guy with 10,000 and you go for 50 years or 49 years. It's seven doubles.
Right.
Okay. Seven doubles is 128. Okay. It's 128 times your money. I gave you more than 100X.
Right.
I gave you 128X in 49 years.
Without having to be without, a genius.
Without doing anything.
Right.
Right. So this is just plan B.
Right.
Where we put the 10,000 in, it becomes more than a million, 1.33 million with no taxes paid.
Right.
There's no dividend, there's no taxes, there's nothing. And we haven't even gone to plan A yet, right? This is just sitting there. Now, the other thing is that every once in a while, there'll be opportunities that show up. And what we're looking for is something that hits you in the head with like a 2x4. So the best investments are ones that make no sense. You cannot make sense of the numbers. It's too good to be true. It's just weird and all of those things. So when these kind of unusual things come together where things don't make sense,
right,
that's when we want to dive in.
Give me an example of a great investment is one that doesn't make any sense. The numbers just seem wrong and you know, to you in the moment.
Well, I'll give you one example where it was a moneymaker for me, but I didn't make even 3% of the money I should have.
Okay.
You know, I mean, it was like, it was given to me on a platter and I blew it. I still made money.
Right.
But, you know, usually the best ideas, when you finally figure that out, they're very simple. Mm. So in the year, I think this was like around 2001 or 2002, I had encountered this shipping company called Frontline. And Frontline was a company that owned a fleet of about 75 VLCCs, very large crude carriers. These are giant ships that transport crude from like Saudi Arabia to the US, and they're just huge. The entire global fleet at that time was 300 ships, 300 VLCCs. 75 of them were owned by Frontline, 25% of the market. The guy who ran and was the founder of Frontline, John Fredrickson, had put the entire fleet on the spot market. So there are two ways he could have dealt with his fleet. He could have done time charters, kind of 1-year, 3-year deals where he's guaranteed cash flows per day and all that. or be a gambler, put it on the spot market and play it.
After delving into the strategic decisions of Frontline and the risks involved in the shipping industry, the conversation shifts to the intriguing question of how to identify investment opportunities, particularly in the realm of crude oil ships.
Oh, that's the opportunity. But the thing I don't get is, why are you looking at crude oil ships? How do I get to, like, how do I even know where to look? And so what is that process for you? Do you pick one industry and look at 100 companies in it? Do you read books on 50 industries? Do you look at what other investors are doing and try to reverse engineer? Like, where do you even know where to look?
I'm going to lay it out for you. It's going to be so easy, but it takes a certain temperament.
Okay.
So first I want to talk about the temperament. Okay. So if we go back to Warren Buffett, when he was a teenager, he used to go to the racetrack in Omaha. And one of the things he did at the racetrack, he was like 14 years old or something, is after all the races had been done, he'd pick up all the tickets that people had left thrown on the ground, right? These are mostly losing tickets, right? They just kind of tossed them from the garbage cans. He'd pull them all out. Then he'd go home and one by one, look at every ticket. He would find, now sometimes a horse would come in second and the ticket was for win or place. Right. It was actually a winning ticket, but they didn't understand they were drunk or whatever.
Right.
So he'd always find a bunch of tickets which were actually in the money, but they had been discarded. So now he was underage. He couldn't go to the counter to collect the money. So he gave it all to his Aunt Alice, his favorite aunt. She used to go to the counter, collect the money and give it to him. Okay. So when Warren became older, let's say when he was, let's say 24 or 25 years old, he went through the Moody's manual. And what he was doing with the Moody's manual, and you know, for nostalgia, I bought these on eBay and I want you to see the Moody's manual, okay?
So this is... Here,
Buffett was 23 years old.
This was his nighttime casual reading?
This was his... So what he did now with the Moody's manual, there were a number of these that came out. So like in the year 1953, this is just railroads, airlines, shipping, traction, bus, and truck
line. I don't even know what this is. Is this the earnings reports of all of the companies?
So this is the value line of that day.
Okay.
Okay, so if I open the Moody's manual to any random page, okay, what it's doing is it's got like two or three companies per page. You can see how fine the print is.
Yeah.
Okay? All right?
You need now, like a magnifying glass.
And it's basically giving you a summary of every company, right? Now, Buffett went through, now, this is just one of them in 1953. For 1953, there were probably about seven or eight of these books that came out in 53. Similar number in 54, 55, so on. So you're talking about a big stack of these, right? He went through these books two or three times. He went through, what he did is, he read each one, page by page, right? And he was looking for anomalies. So he used to host these MBA students, and actually he brought for them printouts from the Moody's manual, the ones that he made an investment in. So he would find something like Western Insurance, for example, where the stock price was 15 and the earnings last year were 25. Okay, the stock is $15 a share. Earnings are $25 a share. Book value is $80 a share.
Right.
Okay. That's what we call an anomaly, right? Hitting you by a head with a 2x4. Makes no sense, right? He would make a list of all these companies that made no sense in the positive direction.
Right.
Okay. And then he'd study them. And then he would make investments, right? Now, in order for Warren to find Western Insurance, he might have had to spend 14 hours a day, okay, nonstop reading these for 3 months before he finds one or two of them. But he only needs very few of them. And Warren's mind, you know, he's a prodigy. So his mind was programmed to have this intense, the work never bothered him. Just like no other teenagers were going and collecting all those tickets on the floor and then going through each one with the optimism that I am going to find something that is basically a free lunch,
right?
After delving into Warren's meticulous approach to identifying investment anomalies, the discussion shifts to how modern investors can leverage resources like Value Investors Club to uncover similar opportunities without the same level of intensity.
And so he went through the Moody's manual and basically started finding the anomalies and then started making investments in them and did well, etc. Now, we have a shortcut, you know, because I know that your listeners are not going to do what Buffett did. Okay. I cannot do what Buffett did. I do not have the wherewithal and the ferocious intensity that Warren does. Almost no one does. I think that he's just an extreme anomaly on that front. So, for example, there's a website called Value Investors Club. Mm. Okay. Now, if you go to Value Investors Club, it's free. You don't have to pay anything, whatever. If you give them your email, you can see all ideas that are 60 days or older. Okay. It's very difficult to become a member of Value Investors Club posting ideas. So it's like a curated website.
Right.
Okay. The members have to submit 2 ideas a year, which get a decent rating in order to keep their membership. So you have, what I have found is the Value Investors Club has a lot of brain power. It has brain power coming out of their ears. Okay. It's all free. So all someone has to do is sit down and read the write-ups on Value Investors Club. So there may be, I don't know, 600 or 700, 800 write-ups, maybe 500 write-ups in a year. Each write-up may be around 10, 15 pages max. Then there's comments and whatever. But what I'm saying is that it's much easier than the Moody's manual.
Right.
Because someone is actually digesting the information for you.
And you could do one of those a day.
You could easily do one. Well, one of those a day is pathetic.
I'm saying even you said if there's 300 total,
yeah,
that's
but I'm just saying
less than a year.
It would be easy for someone without putting too much work into it
right.
to read 4 or 5 ideas a day.
Right.
I mean, they could have a full-time job and easily do that. That's
right.
not a difficult thing to do. And you don't need to read the whole idea. What I would say is you read the first few paragraphs and see if this is something that's interesting you or not, or something that's grabbing you or not.
Right.
Right. And what I do is I look at every idea that's posted. Right. And I don't care to really look at them right when they're posted, because they actually, those ideas will work even 5 years from now. Like recently I started investing in a company where the original write-up was in 2021. Okay. It's 2025. Still valid. Okay. Now, what you still have to do is you should use it only as an input to ideas, just like the Moody's manual is not telling you what to buy and sell.
Right.
Once you see the idea, you do all your own work, do your research, do everything. Make sure it's something you understand well. Make sure it's within your circle of competence, whether you buy into the idea or not, etc. And Buffett is still doing this. So his Japanese bets. So there's another book called The Japan Company Handbook.
Okay.
And I'm going to bring The Japan Company Handbook.
Okay. All right, here we have it. And I'm excited about this because you hear a lot about Buffett's, you know, See's Candy, Coke, Geico, like those kind of well-known yeah. Buffett's best bets.
Yeah.
But as I understand it, Buffett made some incredible investments in Japan.
So just let me explain how no-brainer, the total no-brainer nature of that bet.
Right.
Okay. So these 5 Japanese trading companies had a 8% dividend yield. Okay, so they were paying an 8% dividend. It was very cheap. Japan has, the index has not gone anywhere for like 30 years. And Warren actually got an insane return on these. So what he did is he borrowed the entire amount in yen at 0.5% a year.
And it was not a small amount. It was like 5 billion.
Yeah, yeah. He put 5 billion, but he borrowed the 5 billion at 0.5%.
The whole thing.
In yen.
Yeah.
In Japan, right? So now he's bought a Japanese company paying dividends in yen, which he's bought in yen, right? The dividend coverage is 16 times his interest payment.
Having delved into Buffett's strategic investments in Japan, the discussion now shifts to the competitive landscape of retail, highlighting how industry giants like Walmart learned and adapted from their rivals to dominate the market.
They took a lot from Sears, they took a lot from Kmart, and then they killed them. And they kept learning from one competitor after another. Sam Walton actually used to say, I'm not the smartest tool in the toolbox. I'm not a smart guy, but I'm a learning machine. I'm going to keep at this. And what others have become. So, you know, it's very funny. He goes and visits Sol Price, the founder of Price Club, which eventually leads to Costco, right? And he looks at Price Club and he says, this is fantastic. And he creates Sam's Club, right? And Costco was also taken from Price Club. So both Sam's Club and Costco, they would not have existed.
So Sam's Club is Sam Walton. I didn't even know that.
It's part of Walmart.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
Oh, yeah, it's part of Walmart. And it was completely cloned from Price Club, which was a predecessor to Costco, right? So Sol Price, who was an incredible entrepreneur, someone goes to him and says, you know, no one has had more impact on retailing than Sol Price, because Sol Price influenced Sam Walton in a major way, and he influenced Jim Sinegal, the founder of Costco, in a major way. I mean, right. These are the pillars, and then these two companies influenced Amazon.
Right.
Right? So it's all coming from Sol Price. So someone told Sol Price, you know, you are like the father of retailing in the U.S. and actually globally. What do you think of that? He said, I wish I'd worn a condom.
Too good. That's amazing. So Sam Walton is...
Yeah, but I just want to say that, you know, this book...
Sol Price.
This is a very good book. And it's out of print and it's hard to find. But I think that it's one of the best books on retailing.
Right.
And so, for example, some of the things that Costco does, Costco pays 50% more than Walmart pays its employees. So the entry-level people are making 50% more. Okay? Hasn't hurt their profitability. In fact, Sol Price's view was similar to Henry Ford's view, that I want the people who work in my stores to be able to shop in my stores. Hmm. Just like Henry Ford said, I want my workers to be able to buy my cars. You know, at that time, automobiles were for the rich.
Right.
And Henry Ford said, no, I want them for everyone, right? So he wanted to drop the price. And I think at Costco, the lowest wage is like $20 an hour. You know, like when you're starting out, whatever. And then they have tuition reimbursement and all kinds of other things. And they get a lot of productivity out of their people.
Yeah.
Because of that.
You've got these books here and we're at your house. We're in your library. You've got, how many books do you think you have in here? This is 1,000 books?
A few thousand
books. Yeah. I mean, just to set the scene. So that your office, your computer's over there.
Yeah.
We're surrounded by a cave of books on every topic. So I see some business books over here. I see investing books. You just brought a retail book about Sol Price, the founder of Price Club, from over there. There's science, I think, on that wall. What does this door go to? What is this?
That's like my bedroom.
That's a bedroom. Okay, so you live in the library, essentially. Yeah. And you nap every day, I think?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we're both nappers.
I've been so used to napping that if I don't nap, my productivity goes down.
Yeah.
And so I actually don't like to work if I'm not productive. And what I find is that even if I, you know, lay down for half an hour, 45 minutes, I'm re-energized.
Right.
And I think for the work I do, I need to be all in.
Yeah.
So I actually can't do this work if I'm tired, you know?
Yeah. There's this athlete, Conor McGregor, and they asked him about his training schedule. And he said, you know, one of the big mistakes I made is that I was always trying to train all the time. I wanted to come to the gym 3 times, 4 times a day. I thought that's how you win. And his coach was basically, you're like a light that's always just dimly flickering because you never turn off, mm-hmm. and therefore you can never turn on and be as bright and as effective as you could be.
Yeah.
And this flickering dim light, it's not doing you any justice. And so I've used that in my own model of like, where's my light right now? And if I need to just shut it down briefly, 30 minutes, an hour, whatever it is, to come back full brightness.
Having delved into the importance of maintaining energy and focus in one's pursuits, the conversation now shifts to the wisdom of financial management, as illustrated by Buffett's insightful perspective on wealth and its impact on personal fulfillment.
Right.
And so Buffett has a great quote. He says, I want to give my kids enough money for them to do anything they want, but not enough to do nothing. Okay. Okay. So because I am investing for a living and we have this kind of compounding going, I'm going to end up with more than I need. I mean, basically, I don't need to spend any more than I'm spending. I could not increase happiness by spending more. So there's no point to spending more. I mean, I'm very happy with the lifestyle and everything else, right? So everything else basically needs to get recycled. But it needs to get recycled at high returns. So on one hand, I have a compounding engine and a net worth that's growing. On the other hand, I have to give it away. So God, Google told me that on June 11th, 2054, I'll be leaving planet Earth. Okay. So
you asked AI, what did you do?
If you go to God, Google, and just say, hey, I'm, 52 years old and tell me when I'm going to die, he will tell you. Okay. And now that we have the date, so, my birthday is June 12th, just to make it poetic, right. I made it June 11th.
Okay.
Okay. So we have an exact number. So basically 2054 means I've got like 29 years and change left. Right. And at any kind of compounding rate, it's a ridiculous amount of, assets that get built over the time. But I want to end on June 10th with $10,000. Okay. So there's one game, which is to give it away. And the other game is to make it. And we need the two curves to be where the giving away becomes, probably in the next few years, needs to become very much more dominant. So like the 3 million a year needs to go to 5, 10, 15 eventually, and so on. And so for me, it's the same as playing blackjack. It's just a math game. These are both math games, right? And yeah, there are a lot of families getting helped. And my investors are happy. And so then that's fine.
Okay, so what was your blackjack system? I'm skeptical.
So the blackjack system, it would destroy the casino. They would have to either change the game or something. But basically, I'll give you some pointers of kind of what's going on here. There's a publication called BJ21, BJ21.com. Okay, if you go to BJ21.com and you give them $100, they're going to give you a PDF. It gives you the odds of every blackjack table in North America. Okay, so for example, if I go to the Wynn Las Vegas, right? The Wynn Las Vegas has a bunch of different blackjack games, single deck, double deck, six decks, whatever else. Every single one of those, it gives you the odds if you play perfect blackjack. And these odds vary depending on how competitive. So if I'm going to some, riverboat in Indiana, I'm not going to get the same odds as Vegas. Vegas Strip is going to be more efficient because it's more competitive. So usually the house will end up with something like a 0.3, 0.4% all the way to like 2%
edge
over the bettor, which means every bet you're making, if you make a $100 bet, every bet you're making, you're losing 50 cents or whatever. So there's a casino in Vegas called the El Cortez. And the El Cortez is a small casino. So in order to kind of induce people to come, they kind of improve the odds. Okay, still in their favor. But the single deck game at the El Cortez has the thinnest house edge of any blackjack table on the planet.
Okay.
The house edge is 0.18%. Okay. So if you look at that BJ21, all of their, they have the edges of every table. This one is the lowest, right? So this is a very thin, and I have a system which took them a long time to figure out. They play single deck blackjack, right? But they only deal half the deck.
Right, then they shuffle.
So the reason they deal half the deck is so they can just make it difficult for the counters, because you may be counting cards. The deck becomes very favorable, but then they shuffle.
Right.
Right.
After delving into the intricacies of the El Cortez's unique blackjack strategy, the conversation shifts to the remarkable journey of Rakesh, whose financial acumen and background as a chartered accountant propelled him to extraordinary heights in the investment world.
And I think Titan is still in its infancy.
Right.
And I think Rakesh made a huge, I mean, Rakesh, I think, compounded at north of 40% a year for several decades. It's unbelievable. And, you know, he started with like $10,000 borrowed. You know, didn't even have that on his own. Someone lent him the money.
What made him great? Was he a brilliant mathematical mind? Was he, you know, because what was the trait that really helped him?
I think he was a trained CPA, India's equivalent of CPA, chartered accountant. So he obviously understood numbers well. And just before he died, so he had figured out that IndiGo, which is a low-cost carrier in India, they have like something like 70% market share, growing very rapidly. It might become the largest airline in the world. I mean, they've got like 1,000 planes on order or something. Okay, so they're growing very fast. He had done well as an investor in IndiGo, but then he took the next step and he set up a clone of IndiGo. I mean, just think about the guts you need to set up a bloody airline, okay, from being a passive investor. And while he was dying, you know, he was like in bad shape, in hospital and all of that. And that airline's up and running and cranking and all of that and doing great. So if he had lived longer, I think he would have gone not just as an investor, but also shown that he could be an operator.
You said something like if he had lived longer, this idea of like runway and how early you start matters a ton.
Yes.
Even Buffett, I think you've said that had he not been giving away so much money along the way.
He'd be the wealthiest guy,
He'd be the wealthiest guy in the world right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess when you go talk to people, are you just sort of like, you know, you should have started 30 years ago? Is that the number one message?
Well, what we started our conversation with, right? Yeah. I think the important thing is that if there's a young person listening, it's really important that they start. You know, the funny thing is that if you look at the rules for an IRA or a Roth IRA, there's no minimum age. You could be 6 months old and have an IRA.
Right.
The only rule is that you can only put in wages that you earn. And I was just reading in the Wall Street Journal, there's some entrepreneur who's hired his kids who are like 4 years old and like 6 years old to do like different things in the business because he's putting like 6,000, 7,000 into their Roth IRAs,
right?
Which is equal to their W-2 earnings, right? And probably stretching the limits of what he can get away with the IRS. That's beautiful. I mean, the thing is that, but even if you're not doing that, if you start at 22, I mean, that's the important thing is that when you start earning at 22, a small amount saved at 22 is more important than a larger amount saved at 32, right? Because you get started earlier.
Right.
So it's really important to have the whole spend less than you earn and put it into Berkshire. Set it and forget it.
Right.
Because then if you start at 22 and you're 22 today, you're going to live over 100.
Right.
You know, you're going to go to 100, 110 by the time, you know, because all the advances taking place. That's a 90-year runway. I mean, a 90-year runway is something. I mean, if you're talking about even a 10% return, we are only going to look at doubles, right? So every 7 years, that's 2^13. 2^10 is 1,000. That's 2,002. That's 8,000x. Okay. The first 10,000 you invested is at 8 million.
Right.
The second 10,000 is another 8 million. You know, so the thing is, it's a mind blowing amount of money if you start early.
Right.
So the length of the runway is really important.
Do you pay attention to the macro? Because, you know, my head starts to spin. It's interest rates, and then there's wars, and there's all these different factors that you could pay attention to. And there are some people who really pay attention to that. Do you pay attention to the macro?
No, because I can't handicap, and I wouldn't know what to do with the information. So I always try to keep the bet simple. I need to be able to explain to a 10-year-old in 5 sentences.
Right.
I'm not going to be able to figure out the macro. That's why I couldn't make that CDS bet.
Right.
You know, it was like so much stuff going on about housing's going to crash, this is going to happen, that's going to happen. I mean, I just couldn't get my arms around it, you know.
In my world, everybody's talking about AI. Do you think about AI at all?
The problem is I bring nothing to that party. Mm. And I'm probably going to get my head handed to me if I try to participate. It's not in the no-brainer category. It's not something where I have an edge. Of course, I do believe that it's transformational. But, you know, I knew the internet was transformational. We've known electricity is transformational. We've known the app store is transformational. But in investing, you can do extremely well without understanding all these things. Mm. We go back to John Arriaga, you know, doesn't understand any of these things, or even Warren Buffett. And you know, Apple is in the rear view window. They sold most of it.
Yeah.
And they might have sold all of it by now. But basically, that was a one and done. But basically, yeah, I think that we don't need to understand flavor of the day. We don't need to understand NVIDIA. Mm. We don't need to understand AI. If you understand it, more power to you. That's awesome. And if you know how to leverage that understanding into dollars you can make, that's even better. But that's not me. So we all have to play to our strengths.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Manish, this has been incredible. Part two, I'm happy with it. I asked you at the beginning, I said, is this like one of those Hollywood sequels where the first one was incredible and the second one, they just did it? But no, I think we did a good job. I think the sequel was, if not better, at least as good.
No, it was fun. I enjoyed it. It was awesome.
That's it for today's summary. To stay up to date with more summaries and news, follow us on X and Instagram and visit our website, podsummarizer.xyz. If you have any comments, questions, suggestions, or complaints about the content displayed, please do not hesitate to write to us at info@podsummarizer.xyz. Thank you for listening.